Welcome to The Wonder, exploring perspectives, rituals, and observances of modern, naturalistic, earth-revering, pagan religious paths. Here are your hosts, Yucca and Mark.
Welcome back to The Wonder. This week, we are talking about creativity in paganism and in our practices. I'm Yucca.
And I'm Mark.
And welcome.
Good to see you again, Yucca.
You too. Yeah. Well, we've got a pretty big one, which is creativity. So we're talking about a few different places to go with this topic. Where do you want to start?
Well, I think what I would like to do is to start with a short story about when I was first getting into paganism back in the late 80s. One of the things that really excited me about paganism was that I saw individuals being recognized and appreciated for their creative gifts. Mm-hmm. You know, we'd be around a fire and it would be a bardic circle and someone would be telling a story and people would be wowed by the story. And then someone else would have a song and someone else would have a poem and someone else would, you know, have some kind of an offering. And and to be honest, I mean, some of those products were definitely amateur rather than professional, but that was okay because the community at large was saying, we see you, you know, we see the value that you bring and the uniqueness of your perspective in the world relative to anyone else's, and only you could have created that, and we celebrate it. And I just thought that was a beautiful thing. It was a part of the cultural frame of paganism that really excited me, as well as the sort of cosmological piece of celebrating the seasons and being rooted in science and all that kind of stuff. How about you?
Yeah, well, I actually want to comment on one of the words that you said just a moment ago. You said that some of what people were expressing wasn't necessarily professional, but was amateur, but it was still celebrated. Well, the word amateur, actually, the root of it is doing it for the love of it. It comes from the word of for the love. And that's something that I've really appreciated about the celebration of creativity, that it is often done for the love of it, simply because it is wonderful, because it is an expression. And it's something that I love about humans. Not to say that other types of living things do not also have creativity, but it is something very, very key to humans. And we have creativity in a very specific human kind of way that we get to experience and really enjoy being alive and experiencing the world through our creativity.
Yes. Yes. I agree with that. And I probably mischose my words when I made that comparison. I think what I meant was, one of the things that has happened in the last century, really since the creation of, well, it might have even gone back a little further than the last century in some areas like painting or writing. If it wasn't good enough for somebody to buy it, then generally people would tend to hide it. They would mm-hmm. not share it with those around them very much. But particularly since the advent of recorded music, our culture has changed dramatically in that the sharing of live music among friends has really dwindled. It used to be a very standard thing, and anyone who could play an instrument or who could sing nicely was really valued for that. And now, unless you sound like, you know, some extremely polished performer, people tend not to think as highly of you for that sort of thing. And I think that's really a shame. Around those circles, around those fire circles, I just remember so many experiences of really being able to get a window into another person and see what was important to them and what they valued and what their experience of living was like. And that was so meaningful to me. And I thought it was a really precious and unique characteristic of the pagan community that I did not see in other religious communities, particularly. Mm-hmm. Particularly the Abrahamic religions, which are all sort of set up on a performer audience basis. You've got your priest or imam or rabbi or whatever it is, and they speak to the audience, and the audience kind of sits there and occasionally sings when they're told to sing and stuff, but it's not an egalitarian sharing in the same sort of way. So that was something that just really wowed me when I first came into the community. And I'll say also that it really wowed me that my own gifts were so appreciated, that what I had to offer in the way of writing and singing were really valued, and people would be effusive in their appreciation of that. That feels good. It's good for a person to be seen and appreciated that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's validating.
It is.
Deeply.
So I guess when I think in kind of macro terms about this, one of the reasons I think that the pagan community is more oriented towards appreciation of creativity in people in a variety of ways is not only because it's a more egalitarian, kind of a flat power structure by and large, but it's also because we embrace pleasure. Mm-hmm. We look for reasons to feel good. We look for reasons to be happy. And we don't feel guilty about it when we do. At least we hopefully don't. I mean, that's obviously, all of us are steeped in our native overculture, and we have to contend with that as best we can. But there's a cultural encouragement to go out there and find the joy. And I found a lot of joy around those fire circles, and I have many, many, many times since. So I think that that's something that's kind of unique to, at least in my experience, to paganism, and it's something that I really appreciate about how we are.
So mostly songs or songs and poetry, or what was your experience?
What was my thing particularly? Well, I'm a trained singer. I did music all through college, and I've mostly focused on medieval and Renaissance music, madrigals and motets and sacred music in Latin and all that kind of stuff.
I did not know that.
Well, now you do.
Wow.
I'm a tenor. Actually, I'm a baritone with a big range, but I can sing the tenor parts. And I've been a member of a bunch of different a cappella singing groups over the years. I'm not doing that right now, unfortunately. I was invited to join something which has now been canceled because of COVID. There's that, and then there's my writing, which to some degree is stories and a lot of essays and things on the Atheopagan blog, but primarily I think of myself as a poet. I've published a lot of poetry. And more, my poetry is dovetailed with my pagan practice because it's about my experience of the world through a pagan lens. Hmm. How about you? What do you do creatively?
Well, throughout my life, I've done lots of the sort of classical things that we would think of as creativity, painting and sculpture and writing and poetry and all of that. But right now, where most of my intentional creative energy goes into is actually gaming. So I'm a DM or a game master, and that is really an art form.
Oh, it is.
I'm just completely in love with it because it is collective storytelling, and you're weaving. I know you play too, so I'm.
Yes, and I DM'd for many, many years.
And yeah, I obviously play as a player as well, but I'm really in my element as a DM, because you're telling a story, you're creating a world, you're playing with themes, you're helping your players to navigate character arcs, and you're doing it all in a way where nobody knows the actual outcome.
Right.
With a book, with even a video game, with a movie, somebody has decided how it happens. And video games, there could be multiple endings, right? But with a tabletop game, with a spoken game, it's happening in the moment. It's being decided by a group of people. Whatever the mechanics are for the game that you're playing, how that happens, whether it's dice rolls or whatever. But it changes. So I love being able to play with different themes, and as a DM, I more focus on the exploration element and going through different environments and mysteries, and there's obviously a little bit of combat here and there, but you know, I'm not a dungeon crawl kind of DM. So a lot of my whatever's on my mind gets brought into those stories, and then those themes get played with and moved around in different ways through that.
When I was DMing, which I did for, well, my biggest campaign ran for 3 years for 12 hours every Sunday, year round. 12 hours every Sunday, noon to midnight, every Sunday for 3 years. And what I found was that it was a way that I could apply a lot of my education. And there was a lot of autodidacticism that went into that, because I would learn a lot more about cultures and architecture and language and all these different pieces, because I needed to fit them into the game. And then my own creativity could come out not only in story building and environment creating and world building and all that kind of stuff, but also because I could have the bard at the tavern recite one of my poems. And, you know, then, you know, the adventuring party would like clap or cheer or whatever, and I would get a little hit of appreciation, and there would be clues to the upcoming adventure in that poem. So they would have, you know, they would pay attention. It was an extraordinarily creative thing to do. I think it's a multifaceted creative endeavor that that I'm glad is finally being appreciated, because when I started gaming, in the mid 70s, only two volumes of the original first edition Advanced Dungeons and Dragons had come out. The Dungeon Master's Guide hadn't even been published yet, and only the geekiest of geeks, truly, you know, the scum of the earth, were the ones who played Dungeons and Dragons, because it was before the computer revolution. The PC revolution did a number of things, and one of them is that it vaulted smart, geeky people from being beneath contempt in society to being some of the most admirable people in society. And it's really changed things a lot. Being nerdy is a positive attribute now, and it really didn't used to be. So
you would have gamed through the time period in which it was had some pretty difficult PR hurdles to go past with being
The satanic panic. That was absurd. And it I mean, where I live, I didn't have that much of a problem with it because I wasn't really engaging with the kinds of people that would have an issue. But game mastering games like Call of Cthulhu, which literally are full of extra dimensional, you know, beasts and demons and that want to destroy the earth, it could be really easy for people to just conclude that you were summoning demons as you were playing this game. So
yeah,
one of my favorites, actually. I love Call of Cthulhu. I think it's a fantastically moody and atmospheric game.
Oh, wonderful. I personally love to bring in the background music and I love the prop elements when we get to play in person. Recently, it's been digital, but that has actually worked out wonderfully well as well. At least in the, now that we're all, you know, spread across the country and all of that, we can actually find a time that we can game together.
Oh, that's great. So right? you've got a historical gaming group that you've been able to reconvene.
Well, I mean, started gaming when I was like 12 or something like that. So throughout my, different people from different time periods.
That's wonderful.
So that's great. There's that element. But also a lot of other places where the creativity has really been able to be expressed is through a lot of the gardening and homekeeping, everyday life aspects, mm-hmm. which I find incredibly rewarding and helpful for the whole family. So
that's great. I'm glad that you find that a creative process. I'm afraid I find repetitive chores to be sort of soul deadening. I'm an ADHD kid, and so anything that isn't, you know, really stimulating and interesting, you know, really kind of pushes my intellectual buttons, I just have the hardest time forcing myself to do. Mm-hmm. I've been fortunate to find myself a career where I can use lots of different skill sets all the time so that I stay engaged and interested.
Mm-hmm.
But I do feel really good after the chores are done. It's nice to have the house in a good condition, you know?
Yep.
It's all just for 1 second. The laundry is done. The bathroom is clean. The kitchen is clean. It's all there just for a second.
Yes, for that lovely second. But I do find there's tricks like playing music, or mm-hmm. we switch out a lot of things with the theme of the season. You know, mm-hmm. As we move through the wheel of the year, we change out the color of sheets that we have and the types of, you know, what is the cover on the couch and the types of oils that we have in the diffuser and that kind of thing.
Nice.
As the wheel of the year goes. Yeah.
That's great. So where are we with our questions?
Well, I think of our questions, we've been talking about how paganism fosters our creativity.
Mm-hmm.
And we wanted to talk a little bit about the role of creativity in the non-theist pagan community. And I wanted to ask you on that question when we were brainstorming on what the question was, you had specified wanting to talk about the non-theist pagan community. So I was curious if you had a sense of there being a difference between the larger pagan community and specifically the non-theist community.
I do. And that's just because people tend to vote with their feet. They go where they feel comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and there isn't a mutual exclusivity.
Sure.
But people will tend to hang out in the context that they find the most comfortable. So The Atheopaganism Facebook group, for example, which is now, you know, pushing 2,300 people or something. We have a lot of people there who also belong to a lot of other pagan groups, or, you know, in so-called real life pagan groups. But they might spend less time engaging with those than they do with the non-theist pagan community, because that's where they feel most at home.
Mm-hmm.
What I was going to say about creativity and the non-theist pagan community is that one of the places where we don't get to apply our creativity, where for better or for worse other pagans do, is in our cosmology. You know, there are a lot of pagan folk out there who subscribe to believing in a lot of very creative stuff. And there's sort of an echo chamber that can make things real in a lot of those circles, because nobody is willing to say, I think that's just your mind playing tricks on you. So things can become, quote, true, unquote, in those contexts that aren't really true. Whereas in the non-theist pagan community, the science-based paganism that is the name of our show, we're looking for evidence. We're looking for verifiable evidence about what is real as opposed to what is imaginary. And that doesn't mean that we devalue what's imaginary. It just means we don't think it's real. That there's a real difference in that. I dearly love the Lord of the Rings, but I don't believe in hobbits or ents. If I had to pick a creature that I could make real in the world, it would be the ents, because they're really, really cool.
Yeah.
But sadly, they are a figment of Tolkien's imagination, and we all get to benefit from that. In fact, the entire fantasy genre, including Dungeons and Dragons and so forth, really unfolded from that world that he created, and similar worlds by people like Howard and Lieber and people like that.
Yeah.
So Burroughs is another.
And imagery and things like ints are things that we can enjoy and use. You know, I've got a lot of int imagery in my home. And all kinds of things like that. It's something that we can appreciate and love without believing in it literally.
Sure.
Right.
Absolutely. And, you know, I talk in my book about throwing the baby out with the bathwater. And this is something that I think that the atheist community, you know, insofar as there is an atheist community, I mean, I get a lot of emails, and I belong to some online forums that are for atheists. And I think that in the atheist community, there are so many people for whom anything imaginary is an affront. And the logic seems to go, gods are imaginary, imaginary is bad because it's not logical, therefore I reject all of this imaginary stuff. And what are humans without imagination? You know, really, we are beings who imagine and then tell stories. And then we make stuff that reflects the stories. There was a wonderful post on Facebook. I don't remember who posted it, and I can't remember the full list of things, but it was something like, your basic installation human comes installed with the following attributes. And one of them is make thing. One of them is tell story. One of them is communicate lore. You know, things like that. We're all built like that, right? And so to me, being a non-theist pagan is just about putting things in the right buckets, understanding that the imaginary is the imaginary. And, you know, the material reality is the material reality. And not having a judgment that one of those is better than the other, but we use them for different things. I don't step out of third story windows because I believe gravity is real.
Yeah.
And it's objectively real, and it's real for everybody, no matter what they believe about it.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, what I am not going to be interested in is being around one of those pagan fires and having somebody crack open a textbook and read me the equations for gravity.
I'll keep that in mind.
46 feet per second per second. Which, by the way, tangent warning, the rules for 5th edition Dungeons & Dragons do a deep disservice to physics in their
Yes.
Because they cap at 6d6.
Is and, it 6d6 or is it 20d6?
Whatever it is, I fell 80 feet once and survived, and I had 6 vials of alchemist's fire in my backpack, which subsequently blew up because I landed on them, and then broken shards of halberd from some sort of whirling blade trap thing that was happening 80 feet above me fell onto me, causing me further damage, and I still survived. And if I'd been the dungeon master, that would have been like, no, you're gone. You're just, that's it. You're,
yeah.
You've been killed 3 times and that's enough.
In my longer format campaigns, I actually have added in rules for wounds where you can get wounds that take time to heal after your combats. I really try and discourage them from getting into combat because it's actually quite deadly.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
you can't get shot by arrows multiple times and not have that have long-term consequences.
Right, except if you take a nap, then it goes away under the standard rules, which is, I don't know. I would love to see those rules. Because I would like to introduce, I mean, right now I'm playing through a standard module, you know, one of the ones that Wizards of the Coast has published.
Mm-hmm.
I think that having disincentive for people to engage in combat enables greater creativity in the game.
Yeah.
People become more strategic problem solvers if they know that there's a real danger that they're just going to end up out of luck, especially at higher levels.
Yeah. Well, I will send you those, but one, for those listening curious, there's tweaks you can do, like stretching out what is a long rest and what isn't. So instead of having a long rest be your 8 hours, a long rest has to be, you know, a day or multiple days or things like that can up the stakes a little bit.
Good idea.
I'd only do that in a long format, not if you were running like a one-shot heist kind of game.
Right, of course. Of course. Okay, well, glad we worked all that out. That's really important because gaming is life and life is gaming.
You know, it's wonderful. I think that it's a wonderful outlet and might fill some of those functions that at the beginning you were talking about, groups that we as a culture used to get together and make music in the evenings. And that's something that I don't remember ever happening in within my own generation, within the people that I hung out with. But
me neither.
I certainly would get together in the evenings and play games and board games as well, although I don't play a lot of board games right now because I have people who want to swallow the pieces. But
yeah,
in a couple more years.
That's a disappointing ending to the gaming experience.
Yeah, we'll see in a couple years though.
Yep.
But let's come back to we were talking about the role of creativity.
Right, and one of the things about paganism, which is, or at least about the sort of eclectic paganism that I practice and that I think, you know, many other pagans do, is that the religion itself becomes a creative outlet.
Mm-hmm.
Because we get to design our own rituals. It's not like going to church and they do the ritual to you and then you leave.
Maybe you might have a few call and responses involved and you stand up, sit down,
eat a cracker, drink some wine, you know, all that kind of stuff, which can be extremely meaningful for people that are of that religion. I'm not in any way meaning to discount that, but it's very different than, okay, next week you're the priest and you're going to figure out what we're going to do that's going to take us to some kind of an interesting and moving emotional place.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of shared responsibility for ritual making, and what that means is that you're open sourcing the creative endeavor of building a ritual. And when you open source something, you get the benefit of the creativity of lots of people instead of just one.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly in very traditional religions, I mean, even the one doesn't get much creativity because the ritual has been defined. They have to do it that way. They have to read the sacred text. They have to sing the sacred song. Maybe they get to pick the sacred song for the week, but that's about it. And then they write a sermon, which is usually about how bad it is to do something. And I don't know. Obviously, I have opinions. So in paganism, it's very much a two-edged sword, because on the one hand, if we say, all right, we're gonna do a ritual for spring, right? Here's the blank piece of paper and the pen. Now, what are you going to do? And that can be very daunting for people who don't have experience in putting rituals together. And so it can be helpful to draw traditional practices forward to incorporate into these rituals, like, say, coloring eggs mm-hmm. for the springtime. But on the other hand, over time, I think what people find is that by exercising that creative muscle, they become more of a fountain of interesting ideas. I mean, my friend Morning Glory Zell, the late Morning Glory Zell, had binders full of rituals that she'd written, many of which had never been done.
Mm-hmm.
She'd just written them because it was cool to write them and they were cool ideas.
Yeah.
I think that in our particular family of religions, the fostering of the expression of the individual is particularly acute.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's very exciting, even though it can also be sort of intimidating to have to face that blank page and figure out what you're going to do with the 12 people who are showing up at your house in 2 days.
Or hopefully, 6 hours.
Hopefully you give yourself more than 2 days, but in some cases not, as you say, 6 hours. Yeah.
Well, and there's actually something I see over you. So we're on video speaking, and over the side of your shoulder, I see that you've got your focus back there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a place where I think that we often see creativity getting to be really played with and expressed.
Very much so.
Yeah.
Very much so. The focus or altar is an artwork.
Yeah.
It's a positioning of meaningful objects in a meaningful pattern. And what that means then is that what qualifies as a meaningful pattern and meaningful objects can change over time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you had a walk on the beach that was just really beautiful and the sunset was perfect and the air was delicious and everything was incredible, and you brought back a stone or a shell and you put that on your focus or altar, that can be incredibly meaningful for a while. And then maybe a year later, you can't remember exactly where that rock came from. And then it's time to put the rock out in the garden.
Yeah.
And that's okay. It served its purpose for a while. Mm-hmm. And now it's time for other meaningful things to go there, or for things to be moved around. Or if you do remember where you got that rock or shell, maybe you're having a hard time in your life and you want more of those kinds of experiences, and it becomes more central than it was previously.
Yeah, so that seems like a really wonderful place for people looking to cultivate more creativity in their practice, as one of the places that they can start or focus.
Yes. Yes. On the Atheopaganism blog, there's a sidebar on the right-hand side that's got variety of different links to different things. But the top one is, if you're new to this practice and you're trying to figure out how to get started, click here. And it takes you to a post, and the post basically gives you three assignments. And the first one is to build a focus, because anybody can do that. Find objects that have meaning to you, that symbolize something that's important, or that came from a family member that you care about, or that provoke a memory that is meaningful, and set those out and arrange them. And there's no wrong way to do it, which I think is such an important principle when it comes to ritual. I mean, some rituals are more effective than others at transforming consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
But there's still no wrong way to do a ritual. And particularly, there's no wrong way to do an altar, because it's your altar, right?
Yeah.
How the only authority is you. How can it possibly be wrong? So, you know, I have my various things up here. Currently, my candle has a picture of John Muir on it, and it says Saint John of the Wilderness. And I light the candle every night and say the sacred earth when I light it. My underworld altar, which is the shelf below, that's here, with the skulls and bones and all, and pictures of my beloved dead and all that kind of stuff. I light that candle and say the honored dead. And that's a very simple ritual that I do every evening. And it brings me great comfort and satisfaction to do that, and then to see those candles flickering on that focus throughout the evening. I think people underestimate how much just simple ritual behavior can be impactful to their lives. Mm-hmm. And so I always encourage people to start small. You know, just make a little focus, put a candle on it, light it. If you have tarot cards, draw one and look at it. What do the images tell you? You don't have to memorize the meanings. You just have to be impacted by the imagery. That's what they're for. Yeah. Same reason that I log on to the astronomy picture of the day every day from NASA, because I know that I'm going to see something marvelous.
Mm-hmm.
And that will probably teach me something that I didn't know before, because the examples that they choose are like that. It will...
We'll drop the link to that in the show notes.
Oh, good.
Because I would invite other folks to try that too, if that's something that speaks to you, that's a really awe-inspiring experience.
Yes.
Every day, just a little, yep. Yeah.
I wrote a sermon poem today about the sky that the astronomy picture of the day really reminds me of. Actually, I'm going to read it now. Sisters and brothers and genderqueer others, beloveds, let us not bow our heads. No, let us not bow our heads. Instead, let us fling them back, arms stretched wide to the world, mouths gaping in awe, for there is the sky. The simple, miraculous sky, blue or gray by day, dark by night, pale scrim of air that is breath, that is rain, that keeps the radiation out. the sky's wide vault, the temporal of being upon this good wide earth. Gaze upward, knowing this is what I am, where I live. This is the miracle that is me. Do not despair. Be of stout heart, for surely those who live entire lives in a temple must be blessed. Know your good fortune. Say, ah.